Okay, I'm Randall Aragon, 74 years of age, believe it or not. Today's date is March the 6th, 2020. I'm in Las Cruces, New Mexico. The name of the interview partner is Luigi. He's interviewing me, and there you go.
My name's Luigi. I'm 25 years old. Today's date is March 6th, 2020. We're in beautiful Las Cruces, New Mexico, and I'm sitting here with Randall Aragon, and I'm going to interview him about his life. So, Randall, can we start off? I'd like to hear about your childhood. Can you describe where you grew up?
Yes, I can. I was born in Manhattan, New York, which is one of the five boroughs, in a section, believe it or not, was called Hell's Kitchen. It was on 50th Street between 9th and 10th Avenue. It's really about half a mile, not even, from Rockefeller Center. And everybody that's been in New York City has been there, but the Rockefeller Center is like on the other side of the tracks. I was in the ghetto area, and it's not the same now. It's changed. They don't want to call it Hell's Kitchen anymore. They call it Clinton, and not for Bill Clinton, but for a governor in the late 1800s. It was a very tough section. That's why they called it Hell's Kitchen. A lot of fights, a lot of blood, because the river was right nearby, a few blocks away, and held a lot of stevedores loading ships, and they caused a lot of problems. But we moved to Brooklyn when I was 12, and stayed there until I was 17. I joined the Army. Couldn't wait to leave.
What did your family do when you were growing up?
Let's see. Faye, my mother, she was... She did work in her earlier years, probably when my stepdad, who raised me, was a Hispanic in Navajo. That's where Aragon, over here they say Aragon. But all my life it's been Aragon until I got to New Mexico. But anyway, Joe Aragon was a stationary engineer, which means, you know, he ran like power plants in the Navy Yard. You know, the boilers that produce steam, that produces electricity. My mother, Faye, was basically a housewife. She did work before she got married. And all my growing up, my mom was just, you know, a housewife and tended to the house. My brother, from another marriage, he was 16 years older. He's still alive, Herb. 16 years older than me, believe it or not. It's amazing. Anyway, we moved to Brooklyn. I couldn't wait to join the Army. I wanted to be a soldier. My brother was a soldier, and I wanted to be a paratrooper too, believe it or not. So I joined the Army. They signed for me after school, you know, and there I was in the Army at 17.
Do you remember coming home and telling your parents that you wanted to join up?
Well, they knew when I was 12 years old, that, you know, the old what do you want to be when you grow up thing, and I said I want to be a soldier. And then I told him I wanted to be a paratrooper. But my mother kept trying to tell me, I don't mind you being a soldier, but don't be a paratrooper. Herbie was a paratrooper, my brother, and scared the heck out of her, jumping out of airplanes.
Jumping out of perfectly good planes.
I told her, but anyway, I did do that. But I knew I wanted to be a soldier. And throughout my young life, I was part of they had a Sea Cadet program. And I loved the regimentation and the marching and all that stuff. And I did join. They had to sign for me. I was so young, you know, you had to be 18 without signature. And I left and joined the Army at 17.
So when you joined at 17, did some of your friends from the Sea Cadet program or anybody else go with you?
No, it seemed like my buddies were, you know, not oriented to going in the military. Some of them went, they were talking college and all that. I had different feelings. I wanted that regimentation, and it did me good.
What year was this when you joined?
1963. In fact, I went down there. I remember distinctly. I went down to the Whitehall was this section we went to sign up. I went there. I wasn't even 17, and I took the test. They let you do that. I went to the recruiter. I wanted to be an airplane mechanic, and I passed the test. Then it was called choice, not chance. If you passed the test, you got whatever you wanted. So I wanted to be an airplane mechanic because that's what I was doing in high school. There was an aviation maintenance school. So when I signed up, I wasn't even 17. I know what it was. I went down there. When I turned 17, the day I turned 17, I was in the Whitehall taking the physical, all the battery tests, and I thought I was going to leave that day because I brought my bag with me. I did. I remember the little ditty bag, they call it. And I'm not leaving today. No, 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 no. You come back on the 15th. So I had I came back with the subway, and they told me come back on the 15th of February. So I came back, and boom, then I went off to another country called Fort Dix, New Jersey.
So you passed your test. So you got your choice to be an airplane mechanic.
They
right?
did, yeah. As long as I passed the test, for that I would get the exact training, and I did. The Army sent me to after basic.
Did they choose where to send you based on your choice? Like, did you know you were going to go to Fort Dix, or?
Well, no, that you didn't get choice of. It was the actual MOS, military occupational specialty. I was going to be definitely an aviation maintenance, and they sent me to aviation school. And that was another country that I'd never been to, called Fort Rucker, Alabama, which was for a New York Yankee like me going to the farthest southern part of the world. They couldn't understand me, and I couldn't understand them because, you know, we're talking about deep south.
Yeah.
And here I must have sounded like Sylvester Stallone then, you know, because I was New York City, you know. I might have lost a little bit of it, but they were southern, and I was a Yankee.
Yeah, so was it hard to adjust when you got to basic?
Well, you know, I wasn't. One thing I do remember, you're talking about 1963. The Civil Rights Act didn't hit until 64. They still were fighting the Civil War in Fort Rucker, Alabama. I had no idea about that. You know, I hear from New York, didn't even know what segregation was, did not even understand it, you know, and they were definitely, you know, still fighting the war, and civil rights was still not even affected till 1964. And
was basic training segregated at all? Or?
No, it wasn't. No, the military was not segregated. But when I went to Fort Rucker, I do remember, and I couldn't understand it. The barracks, I do remember this. There was a barracks I went to live in, to go to, you know, I was going to go to the training course. And it was two floors. And there was three sergeants in a room, the sergeant's room. And they were going there for training. And then they were going to go back to their National Guard unit or reserve unit. I was full-time. I was active. And then an African-American soldier came into the barracks to get his bed, and they got all upset about it. They went to the company commander, and I said, "Where are you going? You know, I'm not used to this stuff." It bothered me. And by the way, they did make him go somewhere else because they would, that's the way it was then. But the military changed, thank gosh. You know, being a New Yorker, we didn't know what segregation was, basically, you know. It was very much integrated. But that was a shock to me. So, yeah, that's the answer with that question.
What else do you remember about basic and, like, adjusting to that
basic
military
training.
Life? Because you said you wanted that regimentation.
Yeah, I did. I did well. The hardest thing I had in basic training, I think, was my mother. Okay, I did make my bed, you know, and I did help her with housework. So I was okay with all that. But, and I was 17, I would have done anything. I'd have jumped off the roof, they told me, because it was, you know, scary to me. So I adjusted really well, and I looked forward to the rough and tumble stuff. So I think I did well. Most of the people there were like 18 or 19, you know, and they were all, most of them were not drafted at that time. But most of them were a couple of years older than me. But I think I adjusted really well. I was a good soldier. I enjoyed it. I was firing a rifle, throwing hand grenades, doing everything that I dreamed of doing. And 2 months went by very fast. Then I went to Rucker for my
aviation
training for 2 months. No, I think I was there 4 months. But basic was not an ordeal for me because I was enjoying it, really.
How about aviation training?
Is that... I enjoyed that. I had been doing that in high school.
Right.
So, you know, I was working on learning about helicopters and fixed-wing airplanes and learned about, you know, how to fix the airplanes, how to maintain them. And then from there, I do remember this thing. There was another guy that we had been in basic together, and I met him at Rucker. He ended up same course. And we agreed. See, I'm going to tell you something. It's embarrassing. $78 was our pay then. It's probably...
You're talking about per month, right?
Per month. You got $78 a month as a private. I think it's Now it's probably $1,800. If I went to jump school, you get another $55 for making one jump every 3 months. So I agreed. He and I made a pact that we're going to go to jump school, and we agreed that we'd apply. So I know I applied, and I thought he did, and he didn't. So when it came time for my orders after that aviation training, I said, I remember his name. I said, Phil, when do you leave? He said, I didn't do it. I said, wait a minute now. He said, I changed my mind. My mother's this, you know. He said, it's dangerous. I said, yeah, but it's almost doubles our pay. Well, I went myself. And then I do remember the first, I was not a jogger then, you know. I was a bodybuilder. I lifted a lot of weights. I won a few contests when I was a kid. I was a big guy. I had, you know, I was muscular then. Anyway, I wasn't a runner. When you first get there, the first thing they did, and heck, you didn't know that, they make you run a mile. And you had to run it in X number of minutes.
That's for your PT?
It's the elimination test. Here I am at Fort Benning, Georgia. The first thing you do, you get off the bus, they tell everybody and you're with cowboy boots. They didn't run with sneakers then. That was unheard of. You ran with combat boots. So you got it must have been 150 of us soldiers, about my age, and you had to run a mile in I forgot the time, maybe 12 minutes. And I didn't run. I ran because the Army made me run. Well, I made it, and about half didn't. And I seen they separated us. I said, what's wrong? Well, they're shipping out to some other place. So I went, at that point, I stayed for jump school, which was 3 weeks. But it was like, I'm glad I passed. So I went, I completed at that point the 3 weeks of school.
So we talked about jump school. Are you talking about jump school? Do you remember what it was like the first time?
Yeah. This is an old joke, they say. Jump school is, and it is 3 weeks, and it's still 3 weeks. The first week, they separate the men from the boys. And the second week, they separate the men from the idiots. And the third week, they let the idiots jump. So that's a joke. I do remember this to this day. Because, it is scary. I mean, you're running, you're jumping out of towers. The 30-foot tower is made, it's a psychological thing. That's the height that the human body is scares. If you can't do that, you shouldn't be a paratrooper. 34 feet. And there were people that got to the top. And they're crying, and crying and screaming, and they, of course, they flunk out. And, I'd done anything, so I was scared.
What do you jump into when you jump from that high?
Well, you got the chute on, just like a normal chute. You got a line, a nylon line that holds you, and you jump out. It's to get your body position right, because when you jump out, you hit that air, the air at 130 miles an hour. It hits you hard, so you got to hold tight. And it teaches you how to get that position, and then you bottom out, and there's a jerk, and again you go down a pulley, and that was fun. But the getting out, jumping out of a door at 34 feet, it's kind of scary.
Yeah,
that's the litmus test whether you're going to be right. Then the second week, the first week you do a lot of parachute landing falls, learn how to fall. The second week you do the towers like that. And there's one tower, you actually take you to the top, and they drop you with a parachute. Like they had up Coney Island, you might have seen that.
Yeah.
That's the first time you actually are in a real parachute. But it's 250 feet. They release you, and you come down. And then the third week, you jump. And I do remember that. I was supposed to be like in the middle of the airplane. When you get in the plane, it was a 119, that's how long ago it was, a C-119, flying boxcar. I was supposed to be in the middle, but I was walking through the door, and I didn't have my hand on the reserve handle. And they want you to keep your hand there, because if you don't, if you hit a door, it'll open your chute. So I was walking through, and I'm 17 and a half then, and I didn't have my hand on it. And he made me do some deep knee benders. Here I got 100 pounds on me, I'm doing deep knee. So I got in the plane last. Well, when you get to altitude, which is 1,250 feet to jump, I was the first one in the door. And he made me stand there for like 10 minutes. And I'm looking out. I said, holy cow, what am I doing here? But I couldn't wait to jump out because I was kind of looking down at the ground. But I do remember that distinctly. But anyway, I jumped, and you got to do 5 jumps to qualify. Then you get your wings, and that's a big honor. So
that's cool. So what happened after you finished with a jump school in aviation?
I went to the 101st Airborne Division, which is the most combat ready, rugged unit in the Army at the time. Well, of course, they had another parachute division, 82nd, but those two are the really, you know, gutsy, hardcore. And you know, here I'm 17. I'm with these. It's a tough unit, and I stayed there 3 years, 2.5 more years, and worked with aviation. And of course, you jump every month. Sometimes I jump 3 times a month with my unit. But from there, I went. I got out. I was 20, and I really liked the military. I had an offer to go to West Point Prep School. I turned it down before I got out. I should have done that. Then I got out thinking the world was waiting for Randall Aragon. Boy, was I wrong. And I got out at Fort Campbell, and I was going to try to be an aviation mechanic. And I didn't have a license. You have to have a federal license. It's called an A&P license, airframe and powerline. And I took the test. I passed three parts of a 5-part test. But you needed that to really get a good job. I couldn't find a good job. I was 20, and ended up working in the factory for a couple of months, and I said, no, this is not for me.
Was that factory in New York? Did you go back home?
It was in Kentucky.
Oh, okay.
Right outside the gate, Clarksville, Tennessee. I got out at Fort Campbell, and Clarksville is like 15 minutes away, and I didn't want to go back to New York. My mother begged me and my father. I said, I don't want to go back there. I hated it. It was, you know, it was pretty bad, I decided, because the Army wanted me to reenlist. And I knew that I wanted to go to OCS, Officer Candidate School. So I talked to the recruiter, and I do remember I re-enlisted knowing that I had the scores to go to OCS. You couldn't re-enlist for OCS. I could only re-enlist for my same job I had. And I re-enlisted for 6 years. Been in 3. Well, I took my test as soon as I got back to my same unit, and my sergeant was happy I was back. And a month and a half later, I got interviewed for OCS. And 3 months later, I was in OCS, Officer Candidate School, and finished that as a second lieutenant. Started my career as an officer.
What was OCS like?
It was 10 times harder than basic training. It was definitely just a lot of harassment, a lot of trying to break you down, stress, to see if you had the gumption and the factors to withstand, you know, being a leader under combat, you know, because you're a leader now, you know. If you break down, you know, your guys are going to get hurt. So I did that, went to OCS, graduated second lieutenant, then I went to flight school. I was aviation, remember?
Right.
So I went to flight school. I wanted to be a pilot, but I had a knee injury, and it didn't work out. After 4 months, I had a flying deficiency. And they told me I could have got an operation. I was lifting a lot of weights, and my knees were not, my left, I can't remember, I think my left knee had a calcium on it, and I was erratic on the rudder. So I dropped out of flight school. I could have probably got an operation. And then I went back to my branch, which was transportation at that time, and became first lieutenant. Back then, you went from second to first, after a year, and then you went from first to captain in a year. So 2 years after I was in, I was captain.
And what year was this by now that you were lieutenant captain?
I made captain. What happened was they told me as a first lieutenant, you're going to go to Vietnam. You got to go. You know, I didn't want to go because, you know, I just, you know, didn't believe in the war. You know, it was a mess. But they said, you're going. You know, you no choice. So I ended up going there as a first lieutenant. I arrived in Nam as a first lieutenant. And I became a platoon leader, which is over about 45 people.
Yeah. And what year did you get to?
I got there 68. November of 68. And they gave me the job as commanding 45 people, 45 soldiers in Nam at Long Bend. And then about 2 months later, I knew I was going to get promoted. And the battalion commander and I talked, and I said, you know, I'd like to be a company commander, you know. And he said, and he was very critical on who he selected. He said, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, look, I could handle it. So when I turned 24, And a week and a half later, he gave me command of this company. And I became a company commander. I had 326 soldiers reporting to me at 24. And that same night, do you remember, the same night I took over command, you know, you have a command ceremony, change of command. You know, the flag goes from the old captain to the new one. We got attacked. We got hit by mortar. Big, bad attack.
At a camp that you were at?
Yeah, it was the Tet Offensive. It's an annual celebration of the Vietnamese, and they're trying to blow us off the map. So we got mortars coming in, and in the perimeter there, we had about 15 VC Vietnamese were killed in the perimeter with satchel charges on their back. They were trying to go through that area because the ammo dump was on the other side of the base, and this was the weakest side, so they were trying to penetrate there. But my guys and the other security people, you know, we repelled them, and about 15 were KIAs. And it was fighting, shooting all night. You know, I was trained for it. I'm nothing special. I mean, I just did the right things and, you know, had the training, and my guys did a great job. I didn't lose anybody, thank God.
That's great. And when you were deployed to Vietnam, were you worried about that? You know, combat and all of that stuff.
You know,
what was going through your head?
You know, we were losing lots of people. We had 58,300 something died there. And this is this part of the war, 68, 69, was the biggest buildup. We had a 500,000 troops in Vietnam. The army, the whole army now, doesn't have that much, or has that that amount. But we had that many alone in Vietnam. So lots going on, you know. In our hooch, we call it a hooch, it was a metal hooch. We had sandbags around the building, around there, maybe about waist high. So if mortar came in outside, it would stop. But if it came in the hooch, you know, it's lights out. So you're wondering when you know, because we had mortar attacks, you wonder, well, is it going to be mine? You know, you always wonder that, but you kind of get used to it. A lot of drinking go on in with the soldiers. Especially the officers, and I had one lieutenant. I do remember, Jim. I won't say his last name, but I had to get him out of the officers' club every night. He was my lieutenant. I was a captain, because he would drink all night if you let him, and he kind of wanted to stay intoxicated because he was frightened.
Yeah, because people. But
I needed him.
Needed ways to cope with that, right?
So. I had to wake him up. I had to go get him once. We got attacked. The battalion commander had a. Had an issue, well, not an issue. He surprised us with a practice deployment. See, I had 30 of my 300 people, 326 people, were part of this reactionary force. Well, he came by and said, alert, go ahead and start it, you know, implement it. Well, he's in charge. I had to get him out of the club, and he was not fit. So I had to, you know, hide him from the battalion commander, and I took over. But I had to discipline him, because you know you can't be intoxicated every night. But anyway, Nam was definitely I think one of the questions here was, what is the most, you know, the when I had served my time as commander and did really good, got awarded, you know, medals for leadership in combat, which I'm proud of. But the thing is, I had about 35 days left. Oh, wait a minute. I served 8 months as a company commander. I was supposed to serve only six, but the new battalion commander came in, and he said, look, I'm new, Captain Maragon. Can you stay a little longer as a commander? Because it's rough.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, I'll stay. So two more months I stayed, which I should have only had six. Well, at the end of that, he put me at the operations section, S3. I became an assistant operations officer. Well, I knew I had 35 days left, and the major came in, and he didn't like, he was artillery. And at that point, I was transportation. He did not like us, because we were not artillery. He told me that I need you to gather, we're gonna have a mission from the battalion commander, that I want you to be in charge. He wants a captain, a sergeant, and 20 and 30 enlisted men to walk the perimeter looking for booby traps. I had 35 days left, and here I'm going to be looking for booby traps, you know, bombs, landmines. So I, you know, they were all supposed, I do remember this, we were supposed to meet at, let's say, 3 days later, and he told all the commanders to have their troops there. Well, it was me and about 10 showed up. 20 people, some of them went AWOL because they were short-timers. They weren't going to do this. And they had a right, they had to go chase them down. So I finally ended up with the 30, and we did that for 30 days and never found a booby trap. But, I mean, you think you're going to find one, it might be your lights out for you because you might step on it. So I did that, and then, of course, I returned to the United States.
Great. So talk about returning to the United States. What was it like when you got out?
I was still in the Army.
Oh, you're still in, right.
I came back from my 1 year. You served, back then, you served a year in Vietnam. That was the tour of duty. It was very bad. We were treated like aliens because, you know, you probably heard about it. The Vietnam vets, it was a war. It was not a popular war, you know. You know that. It was like they called us baby killers because there were some bad incidents. You probably heard about it where they actually killed a bunch of children and women and old men in a village and you know, just mowed them down because, you know, the command was, you know, there were some BC infiltrators. Well, when we came back, everybody was put in that basket. And I do remember I was treated very bad. I do remember that. I remember I was trying to get my degree. I had a couple of years of college. I wanted to make it a career. I wanted to, you know, they told me I had to have my 4-year degree. So I started to go to finishing up. And I wore my uniform by mistake in the college. I usually went to school, and I was working nights in California. I was in charge of security. So I usually went to school in the morning, came back to the house, got on my uniform, and then drove to work. Well, this one day, I wore my uniform to the school because I was going to go from school to work. Well, that was a big mistake. The teacher wouldn't answer when I raised my hand. She acted like, she was my age. She wouldn't even look at me because she realized I was a soldier. And the students were, you know, when I walked down the hallway, it was like parting the, you know, the Red Sea. They were looking at me like I had leprosy. And I didn't know, I had been just got back from Nam, you know, about a month and a half. Mm-hmm. And I told my boss, who was a major, I said, you know, let me tell you the story. He said, you wore your uniform to school? I said, yeah. He said, you might not pass that course. And he was serious. So I learned my lesson. I never wore it again to school. They were not, now the soldiers are really respected. They come back from the Persian Gulf. They're honored. Not then. That's why they're doing all these ceremonies now for the Vietnam vets.
So how was it? How did you get through that? What was it like to deal with that?
It was pretty rough. You know, I was still a kid. Well, kid, it was your age. But the thing is, I understood. You know, I just understood that we were not. You know, I spent a year of my life thinking I might be snuffed out any day in leading my troops or lose some of my guys. And here, look at how they're treating me. And, you know, I was there, you know, ordered to be there. So it was stressful, you know, and I'm lucky. I still remember it to this day, you know, forget 40 years ago, 45 years ago. But they're making up for it. They're doing a lot of ceremonies now. Like I'm a guest speaker at one at the end of this month, Vietnam Memorial Day. They've realized they made a mistake, but it was just, you know, the world how it was back then.
Yeah. So you circled a few questions here that I wanted to get
to.
Yeah,
sure.
One of them was, did you ever get caught breaking any rules?
Yeah, you know, I had 24 and a half years in service, but I think I do remember, it was not really breaking any rules. It was probably, it's a Vietnam thing again. I got a call, okay. I went to my battalion commander, who was a West Point graduate, and he was tough. He's the one that asked me to stay, that I just told you about, 2 more months because he was new.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was nice. This guy was really tough, and I'm not going to say his name, but he's not even alive anymore, by the way. But I'm not. But anyway, he was a tough cookie. Well, I'm a captain. He's a lieutenant colonel, battalion commander. Okay, we had a meeting, and in the meeting he said, the general is coming to watch. To do an inspection, or not inspection, a walkthrough on our We loaded ships, and we all, my guys loaded ships, and we were all also doing the security for the port in Vietnam. It was Newport Army Terminal. And he said, I want the cargo area to be, make sure it's manicured, you know. Okay. So I went back after the meeting, and I told my sergeants and my platoon leaders, lieutenants, what I just told you. Okay, I drove from there, because you didn't leave. So I got, that area, that port was 20 minutes away from where we lived. So you don't just get in a Jeep and drive in Vietnam. You wait for a convoy, because, you know, you're going to get attacked. So the MPs would lead it and provide protection. So I had to wait for the convoy to go back to, you know, where we slept, the housing area, back at Long Bend. So I got back, and about 1 o'clock in the morning. Now I got back about 6. About 1 in the morning, I got a call from my charge of quarters, and he went down, woke me up, said, "Captain Aragon, headquarters is on the telephone." And I get up there, and it's a major. I do remember this major. Good guy. He says, "Captain Aragon." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "I just want to let you know your deep draft 3 and 4 was mine." He said, "There's a piece of dunnage on the ground. Dunnage is a piece of wood that you put the pallets on to keep them off." I said, "Okay, are you kidding me?" So I said, "What about that piece of dunnage?" He says, "It was supposed to have been cleaned up." I said, "Well, I know. I told my staff that." And I said, "Okay, well, when we hang up, I'll contact them, my lieutenant." And in the back, he said, "You need to come and do it." I said, "Major, wait a minute. You know, I'm going to have to wait for a convoy? And are you kidding me?" He says, "No." I said it again. "Come on." He said, then I heard in the background, I said, who told you this? And then in the background, I hear the colonel. "I told him to do that." I said, "Holy cow," you know, to myself. And I paused. I said, "Okay." And they were silent. And I said, "Okay." So I said, "Thank you, Major." We hung up. And woke my driver up. And I told him the story. He said, "Are you kidding me? We're going to drive all the way there and could get attacked to move a piece of dunnage?" So I got back. We drove there. It took us 3 hours to get there because you had to wait for a convoy to form. And I went back on the pier, and my lieutenant was there, and my sergeant drove up. I remember Sergeant Finkel, Steve Finkel, bless his heart. I told him that. He says, "Captain Aragon, I'll take care of that." I said, "No, you better not. They might have somebody spying on me. I've got to move that piece of wood." He said, "Holy cow, are you kidding me?" I said, "No, I'm not." So I moved it, put it in the Jeep, drove it to the pile of junk. That was, you know, you heard the word chicken, you know what? That was it. Yeah, it was chicken stuff. But I'm not going to say what it was. But the thing is, everybody knew he was that way. And that was wrong, you know. Anyway, that's something I do remember.
Yeah, that's great. I've got a few more questions. So you talked about coming back home. When did you finish up in the military? When did you leave?
Okay, I left the Army. I had 12 and a half years active duty. I was a captain, been a captain like 7 or 8 years. I chose to get out. It was just too much moving. I chose to get out. I really dreaded it. Anyway, I went into law enforcement right after I got out, and I went to work for a sheriff's department. That's what started my police career. I tried to get in the reserve, and you see, everybody was getting out of the military then. War was over, and it was a waiting list like 5 years. I went to the National Guard. This is in South Carolina, and the guard said the same thing. I said, "Man, I'm a captain. I've been in combat. Didn't matter. Everybody's getting out. They want to go into the guard." And I really missed the military. I try to go back in, and it was, you know, like, no, everybody's getting out, and they're trying to reduce it. So that was out. So I went to work for the sheriff's department. About a month later, the guard called me, a colonel, and he said, "You know, we're really impressed with your record, and we're trying to hire people that have got ex-combat experience. You had to have been combat." and you were one of three selected to be interviewed. So I went there, was interviewed by a general, a two-star general in South Carolina. He was over the whole National Guard. And I was selected. And I started my Guard career, stayed another 12 years, and my branch was changed to military police, and because I was a cop. And after 12 and a half years, I retired as a lieutenant colonel. And at the same time, simultaneously, I was, in police work and became a police chief and stayed with that and became a chief. And I was chief for 29. I was a cop 39 years, of which 29 I was a police chief in six states.
Six states, wow.
I served proudly, and I missed the military. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. It gave me my education. It gave me my college degree, my four-year degree. I got my master's through the Army, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Now, it's not everybody's cup of tea, because some people that don't want to be regimented. I love regimentation, and, it did me well. And
I was going to say, since you talked about some people don't like regiment, what's something that you wish civilians understood about your military service?
My military service? Well, I'll tell you this. This happened the other day, and I might have even told Mark, my T-shirt-wearing guy. The thing is, I was in, Tuesday was the election, for city commissioner, which I was a candidate. So at 6:30, I was walking around Walmart in TRC, and election is over at 7. So, I'm kind of wondering, how I'm going to do. I think we did everything we could do. So I'm walking through Walmart in a daze, and this lady walks up to me, and she knew me. They know me as chief, because that's what they still call me. Even when I'm a commissioner, they're going to call me chief, I guess. I don't think some people know my real name. But anyway, she said, "Chief, I just voted for you." And she pointed to the little, sticker that says, "I voted." "Hey, thanks a lot," I said. So I started walking away, and she said, and I turned around and said, "What was the tipping point that why you voted for me?" They're just curious. And she said, "You're a newbie." Because I've only been there like July be 2 years. And she says, "We need new blood." I said, "Yeah, thanks a lot." So I walked away, and the next hour we bumped into each other again. And she walks up to me. She says, "I want to give you another reason." I said, "Oh, okay." Because she read my flyers. She says, "Because you're a combat veteran." And I paused and said, "Thank you." She looked military. I mean, just the way she looked. I said, "Were you military?" She says, No. It's in my heart to really thank those, especially in the military, but those that have been in combat." And I said, "Oh, thank you." So it really swells me up, when I talk about that. But anyway, Mark's same way. He wasn't no commander. He was one of my soldiers. And it was tough because he was young too. So anyway, that's what I felt like good about. People need to know that military is a hard life. You spend a lot of your time away from home, and sometimes it's really a crunch because you don't have all the goodies that you have as a civilian, and especially if you're in combat, because you could meet your maker anytime. And so that's my feelings.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your time, and thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you, Luigi. Cecile.